This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today's interview with Dr. Avi Loeb runs an hour rather than an hour and a half because Dr. Loeb did not have time to give us a full hour and a half for Dreamland. But nevertheless, it's a fabulous interview about Oumuamua, the interstellar object that was observed from the Haleakala Observatory in Hawaii in October of 2017. Oumuamua means first scout from another place, and this was the first interstellar object in our solar system that we've ever observed, but probably not the first that's passed through it, certainly. And in fact, since then, as we'll discuss with Dr. Loeb, another one has passed through it. Now, this is the beginning of a group of interviews on Dreamland that will cover the various levels of contact and discovery that are going on now in relation to aliens. Dr. Loeb is an example of a scientist who not only does he believe an alien craft of some kind has already passed through our solar system, but also that we can probably find debris, and he'll tell from other such things that are still orbiting the solar system, probably in the Oort cloud, and he'll describe what he thinks we could do to do that. In addition, there are scientists who are looking now for Dyson spheres around stars on the theory that advanced alien civilizations will control the energy of stars using what we would call a Dyson sphere around the star. That is to say, a gigantic, intelligently built sphere that controls and uses the energy of a star. So we're hopefully we'll be talking to one of the other scientists about that. We're also going to be exploring things like contact using radio. I was at a conference on February 6th, the Global Peace Tribes live Saturday night Facebook show called Saturday Night Alive with Linda Moulton Howe, Grant Cameron, Adam Apollo, and a number of others. And one of the people involved in the conference uses radio to make attempted contact. And this actually happened during the show, and it was quite remarkable. What's more remarkable is when this does happen, these radios can be put into a Faraday cage, which blocks all radio signals, and they keep responding. I have one of the radios, and we're going to have on Dreamland in a couple of weeks Mark Sims to explore this aspect of contact as well. We're also going to be looking into the past and taking a serious look at human DNA. Is our DNA altered, or all completely natural? Are they any indications whatsoever of intervention? And what of the past? If we show that aliens exist and have objects that have moved through this solar system, then we need to re-look at our past, and yes, at the whole ancient aliens proposition, but in a new and much more organized and much more scientifically grounded way. And we'll be exploring how we might do that also on Dreamland with members of the scientific community, because contact of some type is happening. We're also going to be talking about the future of disclosure and the future of the process of discovery. And that's what this whole theme in this type of Dreamland will be. Not disclosure, we're not waiting for anything, but discovery, proactively looking on many different levels. And now, please enjoy with me this wonderful interview with a marvelously brilliant and courageous and very enjoyable, there's no other way to put it, man, Dr. Avi Loeb. If you're hearing this, you are listening to the free edition of Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. I would hope that you would go to unknowncountry.com and join the website, become a subscriber. Plans start as low as $4.95 a month. Our website has an active social media component that is very different from most public social media areas, is in that it is carefully monitored, and it is not a place where trolling is tolerated, so it can be a very pleasant place to exchange ideas and opinions. Subscribers often get to meet the guests via Zoom on Saturday mornings. Subscribers also have a every Wednesday night chat together, which is a lot of fun. Usually I'm almost always there myself. We also have meditations. The whole vast Dreamland archive, so much Whitley Strieber audiobooks such as Majestic and The Secret School that you practically can't find anywhere else. So it's well worth a join, believe you me. Go to unknowncountry.com and join us today. Today we're going to be talking to Dr. Avi Loeb about the object Oumuamua, which passed through our solar system in October of 2017. Dr. Loeb feels that there is a strong chance that this is an extraterrestrial object. Avi Loeb is the Frank Baird Professor of Science at Harvard University. He's been the longest-serving chair in the history of the astronomy department there from 2011 to 2020. He now directs the Black Hole Initiative and the Institute for Theory and Computation, among many other things. He is the author of 8 books and 800 papers. Avi Loeb, welcome to Dreamland.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming to this show and to this group of listeners. And we had in October of 2017, an object passed through our solar system that was unusual in certain ways that attracted your attention, a quite a different approach, in fact, than most of the scientists who observed it. Can you tell us what it was about this object that first made you think that it might be something quite unusual?
This was the first object that we spotted near the Earth that came from outside the solar system. And at first, astronomers thought, well, it's probably just like the rocks that we had seen within the solar system before. These were the relics of the formation process of the sun. And we see them in the form of comets or asteroids. It's sort of like Lego pieces that made the planets that we have. And some of the Lego pieces were left on their own, and we see them in the Oort cloud, in the Kuiper belt, we see it in the asteroid belt. At any event, it looked like this object didn't have a cometary tail, so it was definitely not like a comet. We didn't see any gas around it, and the Spitzer Space Telescope searched very deeply and couldn't see anything. And moreover, as the object was tumbling, its brightness changed by a factor of 10, and that implied a very extreme geometry that it has, because it just reflects sunlight, and the amount of the area that it occupies on the sky changed by a factor of 10 as it was tumbling, and means the object is at least 10 times longer than it is wide. And moreover, the object, the best fit to the shape of the object was that of a flat object, pancake-like.
Thin, then.
So it exhibited also a push away from the sun, and without a cometary tail to give it the rocket effect, the only way to get that push that I could think of was reflection of sunlight. And in order for that to be effective, indeed, the object needed to be thin, sort of like a sail. And nature does not produce sails, at least according to what we can imagine, and that led me to suggest maybe it's artificial in origin. And so this may be our first encounter with a plastic bottle on the beach. You see mostly rocks that are natural, but this is the first.
It was moving at 200,000 miles an hour, which means that in order to get from the outer solar system, the edge of the Oort cloud, which is, I think, half a light year out or something, or more.
Yeah.
It would have taken it thousands and thousands of years just to get that far. In other words,
right.
It's moving extremely slowly in terms by right. astronomical in astronomical terms. And if it came from an alien civilization, it must have left their world many, many, many thousands of years ago, no matter where it came from.
Right. Right. But the thing to keep in mind is, if you consider space, then it keeps accumulating everything that civilizations throw into it. So just like plastic bottles in the ocean, if we keep throwing plastic bottles at a certain rate, and, different cities may pollute at different rates, you end up with some population of plastic bottles in the ocean. And the same thing here about interstellar space. And the most abundant relics or trash that you would find is that is the oldest, because most of the time was spent in that phase a long time ago. And the relatively young relics that you find are a minority, because they just came from a short period of time. My expectation is, if we find objects that are artificial in interstellar space, they would most likely be the oldest. They traveled through space for billions of years. And dysfunctional, think about the Voyager 1, Voyager 2, New Horizons, the kind of probes that we sent out of the solar system, they would not be functional in a billion years.
No, but something as passive as a light sail would continue to function until it disintegrated, and if it was made
of right.
a sufficiently yeah. strong material, it might never disintegrate.
That's right. It may not even be something that was designed to be a light sail. It could be just the surface layer of a spacecraft that was ripped apart, something. The point is, it needs to be thin. And in September 2020, there was another object that exhibited the similar push away from the sun due to reflected sunlight and didn't have any cometary tail. And that one was also discovered by PanSTARRS and turned out to be a rocket booster from 1966 that we kicked into space.
Right.
And that one, is hollow and thin, and that's why it had this push by reflecting sunlight. So you can get objects that are thin enough to show this behavior without them being light sail necessary.
There was another extrasolar object discovered recently, I believe, called Borisov.
Yes.
What was the difference between this and Oumuamua?
So Borisov was definitely a comet. It looked just like the comets we have seen before, nothing unusual about it. There were small nuances, but you get those nuances also within the solar system. It looked like a natural object similar to what we've seen before. Whereas anyone that tried to explain Oumuamua, even those people that tried to associate it with natural origin, they had to invent objects that we have never seen before, like a dust bunny, a cloud of dust, or hydrogen iceberg. There were all kinds of scenarios people contemplated, but the fact that they always had to consider something we have never seen before convinced me that, that it could also be artificial, because that's another thing that we have never seen before.
Right.
Of course, this object itself, we cannot study it anymore. It's now a million times fainter than it was close to the sun, and it's also moving very fast, but we cannot chase it. But there will be new ones that we will find in the future, and in a few years we will likely have another one.
Now, there is in science what I would describe as a never aliens bias.
Yes.
And you came up against this bias, and of course, with your enormous stature in the community, you have no reason to be concerned about what this bias, this might do to your career, which would be true of some other astronomers. Now,
yes,
I know, I remember when I interviewed Martin Rees years ago, he was in the same position. He could say whatever he pleased to say. And he did, I'm happy to say. But in any case, what is this Never Aliens bias about? The universe is so huge. It seems like it's the exact opposite of what the bias should be. The bias should be one of expectation, I would think.
Yes, I think the astronomy community is right now exactly in the opposite place of where it should be. This subject should start from the assumption that we are not special, not unique. Because we see that half of the sun-like stars have a planet the size of the Earth, roughly the same separation. So if you reproduce the same physical conditions on so many planets, why wouldn't you get similar outcomes? And that should be the mainstream conservative, common sense view. But instead, it's regarded as a speculation, and you have to provide extraordinary evidence to convince anyone to discuss it, as if you need to bring an alien to shake the hand of a scientist for the scientist to believe. I think it should be exactly the opposite. We should assume that's the case and then search for it. And unfortunately, people that say it's never aliens remind me of, obviously it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If they say it's never aliens and they discourage young people from entering this field, there is no talent in this field, and at the same time they don't provide funding, then it's just like stepping on the grass and saying, look, the grass doesn't grow. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's never aliens reminds me of the philosophers that during the days of Galileo refused to look through his telescope because they knew that the sun moves around the Earth. So the people that say it's never aliens know that any object that comes from interstellar space must be a rock. They know that, and they don't need the evidence to change their position. And they live in their comfort zone. You know, there was a seminar at Harvard that was about Oumuamua, and when I left the room after the seminar together with a colleague, he said, this object is so weird, I wish it never existed. And to me, that illustrates people wanting to stay in their comfort zone,
yes,
not to consider alternative interpretations. And it's really unfortunate because science is all, you know, the fun, they are taking away the fun in doing science, which is about exploring, finding new things, and not anticipating what you might find, discovering something new. And that is not possible. You cannot discover something new if if you put blinders on your eyes and you're not willing to look through a telescope, or you're not willing to discuss those anomalies that other people observe. So the people that object to the artificial origin, it's not as if they're writing a paper where they explain those anomalies in some way. The people that try to explain the anomalies invent things that were never seen before. But those people that dismiss even discussing an artificial origin, they just ignore the fact. That's what they do.
Well, cultural biases are very dangerous in this world, and it's easy to fall into them. In this case, though, we have the Fermi paradox, which is, for my listeners, I'll just briefly state that it's simply a question, why is it so quiet? And that's a very good question, I think, given I think we have an enormous number of stars even in our own galaxy, like the sun, most of which have been found to have a planetary trail. In other words, they have planets around them, and many of those are in their habitable zones. And yet, it's quiet. It's very quiet. Can you discuss that?
Yeah, so I think this paradox, where is everybody, shows arrogance, because it assumes that we are worth a visit, that we're worth the attention of those others. And as far as I'm concerned, the most likely situation is that we are just like ants on a sidewalk. You know, there are many of us, and we are not special and not you know, we, especially if you go back 10,000 years, we didn't really deserve any special attention back then. And even now, I would say that we are not particularly intelligent. We are not developed enough. You know, it reminds me of friends of my wife when I dated her initially. They used to wait for a Prince Charming on a white horse that would make them a marriage proposal. That person never showed up. And why would we expect someone to come and visit us and shake our hand, you know? And there are some good reasons for this not to happen. For example, most of the stars are dwarf stars. They are smaller than the sun, and they emit infrared radiation. And those creatures have infrared eyes. So they are used to dark red grass on their vacation sites. And interstellar tourist agencies will never advertise the Earth as a desirable destination because we have green grass and visible light, and that's not attractive for them. There is another possibility that, you know, that they are short-lived. Just like us, you know, once you develop advanced technologies, you also develop the means for your own destruction. And therefore, most of them are dead by now. But we can look for the relics they left behind, and I call that space archaeology.
Well, that's an interesting concept in your book, the whole idea of space archaeology, and I would like to get to it in just a moment. But before I do that, what you've evoked in me is a memory of a paper I read. It's not a paper; it's more of a sort of a letter in Science, the magazine Science, in April of 1977. By D.B.H. Kuyper and Mark Morris, whom I'm sure you're familiar with, speculating very interestingly about if someone were to come here, they would naturally prefer to remain hidden, even if, I mean, if they literally have come here, we may well be staring them in the face. And the reasons they postulated this was that they would not want to disturb our culture. Because if they were able to do this fantastic feat of interstellar travel, which to me seems virtually impossible, the only thing that they would be interested in from us would be something new. And if we were basically very primitive by comparison to them, as we have ipso facto must be, their interest would be so limited that our chances of detecting their presence would be virtually nil. How do you react to that idea? I thought it was fascinating at the time I read it.
Yeah, it's a fascinating idea. And possible that if you have technologies advanced enough that they're not detectable by us because we just do not have the kind of sensors that will give us information about things like that. I have another possibility in mind, which is, I call it cosmic, social distancing on a cosmic scale.
Great phrase.
Which I came across after the pandemic. And the idea here is that once they get very advanced, they don't really want to establish contact. They want to close off in a cocoon that inside of which they have all the nutrients, everything they need, and we don't hear from them. Because if they were to contact us, it would deteriorate their lifestyle. And so that doesn't mean that we will never be able to figure out that they exist, because by the second law of thermodynamics, they have to throw their trash. And then we can, just like those investigative journalists that go to the trash cans of celebrities in Hollywood, we can find their trash and figure out what's going on in their private lives.
Now, in the chapter on astroarchaeology in your book, in Extraterrestrial, there's a fascinating – you propose a new branch of astronomy called space archaeology. Can you tell us a little bit about your concept for that?
Yeah, so it's very similar to archaeology we do on Earth. And the idea behind archaeology is that there are cultures that are not around anymore, like, for example, the Mayan culture. So we cannot engage in a conversation with those cultures to learn about them. And the only way we know that they existed is from the relics they left behind. And some of these relics are buried underground, so that's why we have to dig in archaeological sites. But some of them are on the ground, and we can find them easily. By the same token, we can search for relics of technological civilizations in space. And I call that space archaeology. And the advantage here, again, is, as we mentioned at the beginning, that you learn about very long history of billions of years, because most stars formed before the sun, most of the sun-like stars. And they probably had the civilizations come and go near them. And if those produced the space trash, then it will keep accumulating, and we will find those in various places. And the other thing we can find are relics they left on planet. For example, industrial pollution of the atmosphere, or some structures on the, like, photovoltaic belt covering the day side of planet, and artificial lights on the night side without light. If they left the light on, for example, after they died. Or if they had some self-inflicted catastrophe, like a nuclear war, you might find some signatures of that. So there are all kinds of things that you can look for. And I call that space archaeology, looking for relics left behind by civilizations, technological civilizations that are not around anymore.
Now, what kind of, this would need funding, and we could conceivably use the James Webb Telescope to do this very thing. Is there any real interest in that, though, in the community? Could this happen?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly the main frustration that they have, that I'm trying to change the culture that exists right now, because I think that the astronomy community has its heart in the wrong place, ridiculing the search for technological signatures and focusing within the mainstream only on microbial life and, for example, the composition of atmospheres of exoplanets as a way of finding about the existence of life. And by the way, a lot of the plans are being made right now to develop observatories that will detect, for example, oxygen in the atmospheres of exoplanets, planets around other stars. And the problem with that is the Earth in the first 2 billion years did not have much oxygen in its atmosphere. The level of oxygen rose very sharply after 2 billion years. So for half of the Earth's life, oxygen was not a good marker for the existence of microbes on the surface. So if you don't find oxygen, you can still have life. And if you do find oxygen, you might not have life, because it could also form out of natural chemical processes. And therefore, even if you invest all these billions of dollars, you will not get a conclusive answer. So how can we be confident that there is life? Well, if we find industrial pollution in the atmosphere, find those CFC molecules that are produced by our industries, they cannot be produced by nature. And if we identify them spectroscopically with the same observatory, we would know that life exists on those planets. So what I'm trying to illustrate with this example is it only requires a change of mind to search for other things with the same instrument. So it's not as if one is asking for completely separate sets of instruments. It's just looking for something different. And I think one should pursue both tasks at the same time, because the same observatories can give us information on industrial pollution and oxygen.
Yes, and if interestingly enough, though, if a civilization is sufficiently advanced, one would assume that it's going to be in control of its star and its solar system, and conceivably more than its own star and solar system. And if it creates something like a Dyson sphere in order to regularize its existence and prolong it and make it safer, we might not be able to detect its presence at all. Because it might be that all of its emissions are contained within its sphere, but we might be able to detect its trash.
And that's exactly right.
Well, I was thinking, yeah. Oumuamua, could it be trash?
Yeah, so that's exactly the lesson I draw from Oumuamua, that we are capable of now, for the first time, searching for interstellar objects, and some of them may be plastic bottles, like the experience we have on a beach, maybe rocks, but we have this opportunity of finding objects that enter the solar system from outside and spent a lot of time on their travel, you know, probably billions of years from very distant locations. So it's equivalent to going to your backyard and checking all the objects that entered the backyard from the street. And of course, it could have taken them a long trip, you know, a long time to get to us from far away. So they made the trip. We don't need to make it. Instead of us going elsewhere, we just look at our backyard for things that came to us from outside. And I think that's a very effective way to learn about other civilizations that was not recognized before. And I highlight that in my book. I should also mention that I will have a textbook coming out in 6 months or so in collaboration with Manasvi Lingam, that used to be my postdoc. And that would be a scientific textbook of more than 1,000 pages, published by Harvard University Press, that will establish, I hope, the foundation for future research on this subject.
It passed Earth close enough. We could have photographed it, couldn't we? Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Could we have photographed it? Just go ahead.
Oumuamua, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, if we were to see it when it approached us, then we could have sent a camera that would meet it along its trajectory and taken a photograph, a close-up photo of it. But unfortunately, we discovered it only when it was heading out of the front door into the dark street. And So we couldn't really chase it. It was moving too fast. But in the future, as I mentioned, we can find more of the same, especially with the Vera Rubin Observatory that will come online in a few years. And then those weird objects that look like Oumuamua from a distance are the ones that we should monitor. And if they approach us, then we can send a camera that will meet them. And a picture is worth 1,000 words, and then we could tell the difference between a rock and an artificial object.
And yes, and you know, I wonder if the fact that we've identified two extra solar objects in just in the past couple of years means that our ability to do this is increasing, or they're presence, there suddenly there are more of them around, or is it a mix of both?
No, it's definitely just our ability, because PanSTARRS represent the first survey that was capable of finding something like Oumuamua. And if it continues for a few more years, then it will find another one. But the Vera Rubin Observatory may find one every month or so, so there will be many more. But, you know, when I go to the kitchen and I see an ant, I usually get alarmed because there must be many more out there.
Yes.
I think it's common sense to say that there must be a lot of Oumuamua-like objects. We happen to see one of them after a few years of operation of PanSTARRS, but we will find many more in the future. And that's the way by which we will learn about their nature. And my point is, even if they are natural in origin, we will learn something new, because currently all the explanations invoke something that we have never seen before. So no matter what, we should pay close attention to these weird objects that do not look like Borisov, because Borisov looks like a comet. And then we should take a photograph, a close-up photo. I mean, that would be the most conclusive evidence. And of course, at that point, nobody could, I mean, if you see something that doesn't look like a rock, nobody would argue with that.
I've been thinking in reading your book very much about consciousness and its relationship to the possibility of extraterrestrial life. And in our case, the experience of individuality evolved over history, and it's a sort of discovery that we began to make around the time of the beginning of the Roman Empire. Rather, if this discovery started anywhere, it probably started in Athens. And now we have evolved a very elaborate individuality. We feel very much like individuals. The ancient Egyptians did not share that. And is there any reason to suppose that an extraterrestrial civilization would ever have done this? In other words, they might be quite radically different from us. If you can imagine someone with no sense of individuality able to travel the stars, how would we ever communicate? We couldn't understand them, I don't think.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I think we should be open to a lot of possibilities rather than be close-minded and not even consider the possibility that we, I mean, the statement, never aliens, is really problematic. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it will keep us ignorant if we believe in it. And just like the philosophers in Galileo's times, you know, they needed to look through the telescope in order to figure out that they were completely off. And the realm of possibility, what we can imagine for alien civilizations doing and manufacturing and so forth. So the only way to narrow it down is by getting more evidence.
Yes, and how we, beyond waiting for objects, more interstellar objects to pass through the solar system, what do we need to look for proactively out there at this point, do you think?
So there are several things. Well, first, there is the Vera Rubin Observatory that is an improved version of Pan-STARRS, and will have greater sensitivity and monitor the sky blindly. That's important because you never know where it will come from, the object, the next object that you find. Other than that, there are objects that were trapped in the solar system that came from outside. And one way to trap them is to think of the Jupiter and the Sun as a fishing net. So when an object passes close to Jupiter, it can lose some energy by giving a kick to Jupiter, and as a result, it can get bound to the Sun. And there should be a family of such objects that were trapped from outside the solar system. And we can potentially visit them and analyze them, and one can identify them based on their orbit, and there were some suggestions. I mean, I wrote some papers on that population with my student and postdocs. And so that's another path by which we can learn about interstellar objects. And then there is a third one, which is the meteors. You know, the meteors are rocks that happen to cross the path of the Earth. So they collide with the Earth, and they burn up in the atmosphere of the Earth. But sometimes if they're big enough, bigger than the size of a person, they can survive. The core can survive and reach the ground. And some of these meteors could, a small minority of them, could come from the interstellar space. And that's our only hope to put our hands around an interstellar object. So I would highly recommend the monitoring monitoring meteors and finding those that have a high speed such that they represent an object that originally was unbound to the Sun. And we already identified one such candidate with my student, Amir Shiraz. This object was discovered in 2015. But in the future, we can find many more. And that would be another way to find interstellar objects and analyze them. If the core of the object survives when it gets to the ground, we can then examine it.
We have, in other words, it's basically a cultural bias that prevents us from doing these things. It occurred to me, by the way, as you were talking about the possibility that there may be many such objects in the solar system, not meteors, but when we were talking before there, mm-hmm. that a piece of space junk from another world would mm-hmm. be, for us, the most valuable thing ever found.
Yes, definitely.
Definitely.
I should have mentioned also the moon, because the one advantage of the moon, it doesn't have an atmosphere, so objects do not burn up before they hit the surface. And there is no geological activity to churn things and mix them with the core of the like on Earth. I mean, everything that was on the surface of Earth was mixed over a period of hundreds of millions of years. And on the moon, there is no geological activity. So in principle, you can think of the moon as a museum that collects everything that falls on it. And if we could regard it as an archaeological site in the sense of looking what's there. You know, is there anything that looks like an artificial debris that happened to collide with the moon and stop there by chance? And that's another search that we can make.
So there's actually a lot we could do, and we could also search. I guess Mars has been a very passive place geologically for a long time, and mm-hmm. conceivably searching on Mars might also be possible in the future, but obviously much more expensive and a longer term undertaking than searching on the moon. Now. Mm-hmm. You know, when I look at the solar system, I see something that strikes me as aggressively coincidental, I would say. You mentioned Jupiter being like a sieve, and Jupiter and the gas giants, especially primarily Jupiter, draw a lot of debris, dangerous mm-hmm. debris that's incoming from the Oort cloud and various other places, and mm-hmm. that debris doesn't reach the inner rocky planets for that reason. The moon mm-hmm. draws more such debris. Mm-hmm. The Earth is in a rather narrow habitable zone circling the sun. And one wonders if the statistics don't speak rather much against this happening very often in the universe. I can't tell, but planets in the habitable zone might be fairly common, but they might not have the right circumstances. In other words, if there's no moon, there are going to be orbital winds that are going to be so fierce that they're going to prevent higher life forms from forming. Could we be alone? How likely is that?
Well, it's a very complex question, and we discussed it in our textbook at great length, and there are lots of uncertainties, as you point out. Also, most of the stars are dwarf stars, and the habitable zone is closer in. It's 20 times closer to Proxima Centauri than we are from the sun, for example. And the problem is that these stars have flares, and they also have winds. And those can strip the atmospheres of the planets in the habitable zone near them. And we don't fully understand why we are finding ourselves next to the sun when most of the stars in the Milky Way are dwarf stars. And one possible reason may be that the environment is hazardous for life, as you mentioned, around some types of stars. And perhaps the moon is also needed and other things. And this is a very complicated question that will take a while for us to answer reliably. But what we can do in the meantime is search for any signatures we can find. And, you know, it's possible that most of the signatures are not on planets at all. And we shouldn't obsess with planets, finding evidence on planets, because if they sent out a lot of things into space, if they could have even relocated from a planet to embark on a platform that is independent of the star.
If they want to survive on a long-term basis, they might think seriously about not hanging out on a planet that's eventually going to be struck by something that'll devastate it, you know, over time. I mean, ours has been a number of times. Yes.
And I make the analogy between this and the biblical story of Noah's Ark, where Noah was worried about the great flood, and he built an ark to put animals in it so that to save them from the flood. And we or other civilizations can contemplate building a Noah's spaceship. The life forms that you care about in a spaceship, but you may not need to put them on board, but rather just have a computer connected to a 3D printer that can produce synthetic life elsewhere out of raw materials, rather than carry those life forms with it.
Are you familiar with the concept of that was a speculation by Dr. John von Neumann?
Yes.
The von Neumann machine.
Yes.
Which would travel around a galaxy looking for planets that were congenial to its species and create an artificial version of it whenever it found one. I wonder if such a machine could be real, not Oumuamua, but could we ever find ourselves confronting, and maybe we already have confronted such a machine?
Right. I mean, the advantage of a machine that can reproduce, as we know from biology, is that it can become the most abundant machine because it produces a lot of copies. And we don't know. I mean, so the way to make progress on this would be to search and see, you know, if you find a lot of Oumuamua that look just like one another and they are all artificially made, there must be a production line somewhere.
Right. Well, he calculated that one of them passing through the galaxy over a period of 50,000 years would be able to very extensively populate the galaxy with versions of its original species, if that was its motive, which was fascinating because it gets past the idea of, you know, traveling faster than light and all of these things that I suspect are physical impossibilities. And suddenly you have a very interesting hypothesis to work from. And it makes me think that we should look at ourselves very carefully, perhaps in addition to engaging in space archaeology and find out what we are. For example, there's the UFO lore and the close encounter alien abduction lore, which I've been involved in extensively in my life, and it is an outgrowth of the earlier stories of djinn and fairy folk and things like that. And what happens is as the species becomes more and more aware of the possibility that there might be strangers out there. In other words, as our understanding of the universe expands, we also change our attitude toward it and begin to look at it as something from outside of us, which it may or may not be. I really can't say. But it gets me to this question, and I know it must be one that you have thought very carefully about in your life. It's not directly related to your book, but it is perhaps related to your own understanding of reality. What do you think we are?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Of course, the standard scientific view is that we are complex life forms that evolved out of simpler life forms that resulted from a soup of chemicals on the early Earth. And there is an alternative possibility, which is that we came from somewhere else. Of course, you need to explain what created life on that other place, but it's possible that we were put here on Earth by either a rock that brought our original seed, so to speak, here, or that it was what is called directed panspermia. Panspermia is the process by which you transfer light between planets. And directed means that it was done on purpose by an intelligent species. And that always remains a possibility that that life as we know it was not did not originate naturally. But one way to figure it out is to try and reproduce life in the laboratory. And there are several groups trying to do that. One of them at Harvard, led by Jack Szostak. He's quite optimistic. He said that when he started a decade ago, he thought it's really difficult to make living cells in the laboratory, but out of random processes. But now, after working on it for a while, he seems convinced that he will be successful and that indeed the early Earth could have led to the life that we have right now. And so this is to be seen. This is to be investigated.
Yes, it's worth certainly investigating. And when one thinks of we have come to understand ourselves physically just really in very, very recently in the past 100 years, for most of our history, we did not know, we had no idea what we were. The Romans, right up to the mid-18th century, and before, there was simply no concept of what a human being actually was physically.
Right.
And
right.
Now we know that, and we're already at the edge of being able to create life. And in my mm-hmm. mind, I relate this to the advances that are being made in artificial intelligence and how we could, I have a feeling that we're not too far from being able to generate artificial biology, and who knows, we could perhaps develop an organic artificial intelligence that is neuron-based and grown and therefore could be incredibly dense. What do you think of
that? Yeah, I think the future is definitely quite exciting in the sense that biology took a long time, you know, billions of years, to get at the point where we are now. And with our minds, we can create things that are even more competent than we are. And, you know, out of the materials that we find, and perhaps the next phase in our evolution will not be Darwinian in the standard sense, but will be artificial in the sense that we design the machines that will replace us because they are much more capable, and you can easily send a machine to interstellar travel. And if that is the case, then when we find evidence for other civilizations, we will find it mostly in the form of those technologies. And that's why I think it's useful for us to search, because we can perhaps learn about technologies that will take us a million years to develop if they already developed them a while ago. And it may feel like copying an exam, but if we save a million years, who cares?
Well, exactly. Well, we will, because what we're doing is we're speeding everything up very dramatically, and we'd better hurry, because I think that I personally, from our own, this one experience, it seems to me that intelligent life might be quite a short-lived phenomenon. And we're obviously going to find that out one way or another over the next 100 years.
Yeah. I discussed this in my book. This is one of the main explanations for Fermi's paradox, that is so-called the great filter, and the
yes.
fact that civilizations are short-lived. Yes.
They may be very much short-lived. Avi Loeb, I would like to thank you for being with us on Dreamland. It's been a really good conversation. Avi's book, Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Intelligent Life Beyond Earth. I think personally that this book is going to be part of the history of human knowledge in a particularly special way. This is the first time that a serious scientific challenge at a very high level has been made to the never aliens enculturation that has stymied our journey into the future for so many years. Thank you for writing it. Thank you for being who you are. And thank you above all from me and all the other Dreamlanders for being on our show.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me. And I should say, I have hopes for the future because the younger people do not share those biases that the older generation had. And moreover, the book, as of last night, entered the New York Times bestseller list. It's number 7 on it within a week of its publication.
It's going to be a huge book. Because it's time. We are waking up, and perhaps Oumuamua has helped us do that. In fact, I know it has, simply by passing through our solar system and leaving us with the question that you have so very brilliantly articulated in your book. So,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you're hearing this, you are listening to the free edition of Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. I would hope that you would go to unknowncountry.com and join the website, become a subscriber. Plans start as low as $4.95 a month. Our website has an active social media component that is very different from most public social media areas, is in that it is carefully monitored, and it is not a place where trolling is tolerated, so it can be a very pleasant place to exchange ideas and opinions. Subscribers often get to meet the guests via Zoom on Saturday mornings. Subscribers also have a every Wednesday night chat together, which is a lot of fun. Usually I'm almost always there myself. We also have meditations, the whole vast Dreamland archive, so much Whitley Strieber audiobooks such as Majestic and The Secret School that you practically can't find anywhere else. So it's well worth a join, believe you me. Go to unknowncountry.com and join us today.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by unknowncountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.